This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Ronald Reagan signed the country's first no-fault divorce law in 1969 when he was governor of California. He later said it was the worst political mistake of his political career. New York State was the last one to legalize the law, and that was in 2010. No-fault divorce enables a person to end their marriage because of irreconcilable differences without having to blame their spouse for wrongdoing. Well, there's a movement today in a number of states to make it harder to get a divorce by mandating counseling, classes, a waiting period, even eliminating no-fault divorce. And it's our topic for today's Radio Times. We have two guests who have joined us. They are both lawyers. Joining us by telephone is Beverly Willett. She's co-chair of the Coalition for Divorce Reform. Again, as I said, a lawyer author who writes for a number of publications. And Beverly Willett, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us and joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Margaret Claw, a founding partner of Berner, Claw & Watson. That's an all-women law firm located here in Philadelphia. Wrote a book last year called Keeping It Civil, based on some of her case stories as a family lawyer. And Margaret Claw, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much, Marty.
Let me begin with you, if I could. Take us back to the pre-no-fault divorce days. This would be before 1960. What did you have to prove in order to get a divorce?
Well, I have been practicing family law a long time, but not that long. But I am familiar
from what the history books say.
I am familiar with the history of fault-based divorce. And actually, we still have fault grounds on the books in this state and in many states. It's just that nobody chooses to use them. And I can talk about why that is later if you want. But the policy about divorce until the last third of the 20th century was that someone had to do something wrong in order for the state to grant an end to the marriage. And those grounds are adultery, cruel and abusive treatment, insanity, incarceration, things like that. And so what happened, and I think the basis for the movement towards no-fault divorce was that it created collusion all the time, in that people who just wanted to get divorced and had no fault grounds were making up stories. They were filing affidavits with the court. I mean, and lawyers had to go along with this process of people making up stories about what the other person did in order to get the state to grant them a divorce. So it created this legal fiction that was very uncomfortable and, I think, inappropriate. And I think the combination of that and the sort of liberal progressive movements in the 60s led to the idea that people should be able to get divorced just because they want to get divorced.
Beverly, let me turn to you, and you are a critic of no-fault divorce. What do you see as the major problem?
Oh, well, there's so many problems with no-fault divorce. No-fault divorce has been a disaster for the American family, and it's been a disaster for marriage. Actually, I have studied the history of no-fault divorce as well. And if you look at the history and you go back and you read all of the legislation and the hearings, you'll find that there were also some other reasons for no-fault divorce. One was actually to lower the divorce rate. Actually, they thought that if they took away this fault-based and this blame system, that people would be able to reconcile easier because the emotions would be quelled down. So basically, we have a divorce rate that's twice what it was, and one of the reasons for no fault was to reduce the divorce rate. One of the other reasons was to this animosity. We wanted to get rid of this animosity that was going on between individuals. What do we see? We saw a complete reverse. We see that the animosity level is off the charts, much worse than it was 44 years ago when no-fault divorce was first instituted. And what we have seen since then is a very, very small family court system, very, very small number of family court lawyers, and now it's one of the biggest businesses in the country. In fact, I would dare say that there's probably no corporation that's bigger than the child support enforcement mechanism that the government runs today.
Let me pick up on something you said, or taking all that you said. Is this an argument then for bringing back fault divorce? Is that what you want?
Well, I think there are, I mean, basically there are some legislative options that I think in its purest form, I think that no-fault divorce is not legal. I think that it violates due process. So I think we've really got a fundamental problem with the system itself in the fact that basically it allows one individual to basically, smash up the lives of an entire family for basically no reason whatsoever. There's this fiction in the law that says irreconcilable differences or irretrievable breakdown, depending on what state you happen to be in. But actually, if you look behind that, if you look in what happened in New York, which was the last state to enact no-fault divorce, there's no standard behind that. There's no hearing for an individual who is was basically sued against their will. 80% of the divorces are unilateral across the country. There's no possibility to defeat that. So anyone basically, as Margaret said, if they want to get out of a divorce, the fact that they want to, the fact that that is their desire, and basically it's based on their feeling that they're unhappy at a particular moment in time, they are entitled to a divorce. There's no other contract in the entire country where or other litigation where you can literally go into court and the result is predetermined every single time. Well, someone says, I want a divorce, and they get it.
Well, let me pick up on that. And based on your experience, Margaret, as a family attorney, do people ask for and ask for a divorce lightly?
Not at all. I mean, I find the idea of making divorce harder to get so that would be so unpopular with the people I represent because it is such a hard process already. It's emotionally incredibly difficult for people and it's legally difficult. And I think we might be confusing a couple different aspects of no-fault divorce here because there are really two bases for no-fault divorce in most jurisdictions, and that in here in Pennsylvania that's the case and elsewhere as well, where either both people agree or there is a period of separation that's required before the divorce can be granted. So in Pennsylvania, it's 2 years. If one person doesn't want to get divorced, it will be no divorce for that 2 year waiting period, and then a divorce action can go forward. So it's not just as though somebody can leave a marriage and get an instant divorce if the other person doesn't want it. And I would really take issue with what Beverly says about, I'm not sure where this statistic comes from, 80% of divorces are unilateral. You know, I have been doing this for like 30 years, and I would say that is a small minority of the people that I represent. Most of my cases are couples who both agree that the marriages should be over. I mean, there are definitely divorces where one person is blindsided by the other one saying, I want to get a divorce, and they don't want it. And those are very difficult cases. But that is not the majority of what I see. I see people wanting to get divorced, both of them, and their disputes have to do with how the economics are going to work, not about ending the marriage. It's much more a common scenario than the one that Beverly's describing.
Let me go back to you, Beverly. And one of the arguments, I guess, against what you and others are proposing is that if you delay the divorce process, you can create conflicts within the family, within the marriage, and that ends up being harmful to the children. And I'd be just curious about what you say about that argument.
Well, you know, let me just, I'll pick up with that and also a few things that Margaret said that relate to this. And she mentioned the 2 year waiting period in Pennsylvania. That is very unusual. If you look at waiting periods across the country, you will see that those kind of extended waiting periods, I think there's only 15 states that have a waiting period of a year or more. So the majority of the states don't have much of a waiting period, if any. And if you look at some of the states that have very, very low waiting periods, like Georgia, for example, of 30 days, you'll find that the marriage rate is much lower and the divorce rate is much higher. So these kinds of things do correlate, and we do find that when we do have waiting periods, that the research shows us that there are fewer divorces. So there is this correlation between patience, which we basically tell our kids to have patience, and then we turn around and in places, most states don't have much of a waiting period, we go and get our divorce. The other thing is that with divorce reform, it's not just a waiting period, and the organization that I work with, the Coalition for Divorce Reform, that has basically come up with this model legislation. We have consulted lawyers and marriage experts and scholars and domestic violence providers all across the country to come up with something to address the problems that we see with divorce, and basically the research that shows that it's not good for individuals and especially not good for children. So we've come up with this proposal. It's not only a waiting period, but it's a pause with a purpose. And during that waiting period, it's not a time when people are just twiddling their thumbs and doing nothing and waiting for the clock to tick so that they can go file their papers and get in there and get a divorce. We find that that if we can prevent people from going down this long road of litigation, if we can try and get them early and give them information about the ramifications of divorce on themselves and their kids, and what's going to happen, if we can give them information about conflict resolution, the kinds of problems that are leading to the feelings that they're having of unhappiness at the present moment in time that might help resolve some of their problems, that these things can actually help. There's a study out of the University of Chicago that shows that couples who are willing to wait, if they're happy one day, if they're willing to wait 5 years down the road, it compared these couples, 5 years later, they were happy. There's a study from Bill Doherty, who's one of the leading family scholars in the country from Minnesota, asking people when they go into divorce, if you had information, if you had help, if you knew where to go, would you be willing to consider reconciliation? And he found that a third of the spouses that he talked with said, yes, we would. We want that help. We want to stay out of court.
Beverly, yeah, just hold on to that thought only because we're almost up on a break, and I just want to give Margaret a chance for a quick response to that. The idea of some kind of concerted counseling to get the couple to at least talk together before possibly divorcing.
I mean, I think that is really important, and I really can't think of anybody I've represented in the last, 10 years, with very few exception, that have not tried counseling, and many people have separated once and gotten back together. I think that's the thing I don't see. I don't see people taking it lightly. And I think that what is really important that Beverly is talking about, and I would completely agree with, is trying to figure out ways to reduce the level of conflict. And I think that has to do, because that's what's really damaging to children, and that's what the studies show. And there's a movement towards a different kind of divorce process, and I'm all in favor of that.
I'm going to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Margaret Claw joining us with Beverly Willett, and we're taking a look and talking about and hearing different perspectives on divorce in this hour of Radio Times. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. Now through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a year ago, we spoke with the head of emergency at Boston Medical Center.
The first patient rolled in. He was near death. He had lost both of his legs, and we started to work on him, and then it was just one after another after another.
A year later, the caregivers still struggle. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. His was a genius that would reveal itself early, develop swiftly, and vanish all too soon. Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra present a four-concert Mozart celebration, the final three symphonies, and the three piano concertos of 1785. Mozart tickets online or at 215-893-1999. April 24th through the 26th at the Kimmel Center, a Mozart celebration with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about a movement to make it harder to get a divorce, believing that children pay the heaviest price and that marriages can be saved with counseling and even a cooling off period. That perspective has its critics. And we are talking with Beverly Willett, co-chair of the Coalition for Divorce Reform, and Margaret Claw. She's a founding partner of Berner, Claw & Watson. That's an all-women law firm here in Philadelphia. The lines have exploded. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Margaret, if you could talk a bit about, I think people have in their mind a rather probably narrow definition of what a divorce proceeding looks like. Talk to us a bit about some of the other ways that people can get divorced that maybe aren't as contentious.
Well, the vast majority of people that get divorced, at least the people that we represent in my law firm and my colleagues in the family law bar represent, settle their cases, the vast majority. And those settlements keep you out of court. And there is a growing move to stay out of court and use alternative dispute resolution methods, which are less adversarial. And I think that goes hand in hand with a rise in joint custody and an expectation that post-divorce, both parents are going to be involved and actively involved in their children's lives. And that really creates an incentive to want to continue to have a working relationship with your spouse when your family is reconfigured in a different way. And so the popularity of mediation, which is a process where the parties go to a neutral facilitator who can give them legal information and give them a forum to try to work out their own differences, or collaborative divorce, which is a relatively new idea where both parties have lawyers, but the lawyers and the parties work together and they commit to staying out of court and they work together to come up with a solution that's good for both of them. I see a big increase in, especially among my younger clients, in sort of, it's the do-it-yourself generation. They're rejecting the institution of court. Nobody wants to go there. I mean, my goal is to keep my clients away from that building. Unless it's absolutely necessary. Sometimes it's necessary because someone's completely unreasonable. But there are a lot of people who sit down at the kitchen table and figure out what they want to do. And they're using lawyers more as sort of coaches and advisors to write up those agreements, to process paperwork, and to, you know, give them the information they need so that they are empowered to make their own decisions about their lives. And that's what I think is the direction we should be going in, not creating a more paternalistic state that tells us that we must stay in a relationship that we don't want to be in.
Let me give you a chance to respond to that. Beverly Willett, go ahead.
Well, I think what's most problematic with what Margaret is advocating is that we're still left with the problem of divorce. And we're still left with basically what no one is focusing in on, and that is the damage to children. She said that most of the damage to children is how the divorce is handled, and that is absolutely not true. It's a nice sentiment, but it's anecdotal. And what we have now is a body of research from the last couple of decades that show that it's not the way necessarily divorce is handled, but it is divorce itself that harms children the most. We really can't get around that at this point. Yes, is a good divorce better than a bad divorce? In most instances, it is, not in all instances. And I've written an article about that, about the latest research for the Daily Beast. But basically, most researchers are telling us it's not this notion of having the good divorce, the kind divorce. This is a tired and dusty thing that was trumped out in 1969, the late 60s, in one of the reasons to justify no-fault divorce. And we've tried that, and we've had 4.5 decades of it, and what we have is we have the lowest marriage rate in the country. We have a doubling of the divorce rate. We have kids who are not getting married. They don't want to go near marriage. What we have is the highest out-of-wedlock childbirth rate. What we have is most people cohabitating dating instead of getting married. What we have is an epidemic of fatherless homes.
But
1 million children a year in broken homes. We have children, according to a longevity study from the University of California, living on average of 5 years less than their counterparts from intact families. What we have is poor results for children across the board, more drug and alcohol abuse, teen pregnancy, poverty. We have all of these things, and it's basically still due to divorce. Paul D'Amato did this study from Penn State. He's one of the leading researchers in the country, and his team found only modest support for the positive effect of good divorces versus contentious ones. And he basically found no difference between good and bad divorces in so many different areas as far as kids were concerned. Margaret, you say in your video on your, let's keep it civil. And then you say, this is a time when people are the most raw you have ever seen them and the most stressed out you have ever seen them. And then you want them to co-parent in this situation where they have split households and they're dealing with blended families.
Let me jump in.
Fallout that you detail in some of your stories for the Huffington Post.
Let me give Margaret Claw a chance to respond to that. I mean, let me just give you a chance to respond to that.
Well, I don't think divorce is easy, and it's certainly everybody takes an economic hit, and I'm not saying it's a positive thing. I also would disagree, Beverly, with your summary of what the studies show about the effects on children of divorce, because it's not about the divorce. Children fare poorly as adults or have fallout from the separation of their parents when there was a high level of conflict, and that really doesn't have anything to do with a particular time of the divorce, but as an ongoing through their childhood, if there's a high level of conflict to parents. I mean, that's one of the really interesting things in the research is that we now know that there is no particular custody arrangement which is better for children than another, that what causes an outcome that's less than ideal for adult children of divorce is the level of conflict between the parents. So whether it's joint custody or the children live with dad or they live with mom, that's not actually a factor in how children fare. But I don't think there's any question that divorce is hard for children and that it should not be taken lightly. But I'm not sure that the problems of poverty and drug use and alcohol and addiction can be laid at the doorstep of divorce, and whether the solution to that is the state telling people that they must stay married, because you can never compare the people who did get divorced with what those families would have been like if they stayed married. That's a study that's impossible to do. And the research on no-fault divorce shows that it's been hugely favorable to women in particular. Domestic homicide rates went down, domestic violence went down, women's stated levels of happiness about the fact that they got divorced was high. And the fact is, everybody wanted these laws. They're hugely popular. No one wants a fault-based divorce that I've ever spoken with.
Well, Beverly, let me go back to you. And would you both agree, and perhaps even to you, Margaret, would you both agree that if we could work on the front end, which is helping people marry the person that they are compatible with and help them understand what marriage is about before they get into it, chances are we could reduce the divorce rate at the other end. Margaret?
I mean, I think it is ironic that it is so easy to get married and so hard to get divorced. And certainly you could, if the goal is to strengthen the institution of marriage, I think the policy change might be better focused on making it harder to get married. Perhaps there should be a waiting period to get married because there is not anything meaningful. And no one is analyzing the relationship and saying it's okay for you two people to get married. And not that I think that anyone should be, because I think that's, again, a paternalistic view of the state that I don't think people want. But that is certainly another place that you could look to see if it reduced the divorce rate.
What do you think, Beverly, the idea of maybe taking some of the ideas from your organization and using that at the front end before people get married?
Well, I definitely think that that the problem that we're talking about is not necessarily just a legal one and just with respect to divorce. Of course, it's a cultural problem, too, that we have. I think we're very confused about what marriage is in our culture. And what marriage does, and one of the things that we would seek to have, and some of these laws that have been proposed, is to talk to people about what the benefits of marriage are. What is marriage? We do have a culture that I thinks that marriage is about our soulmate and marriage is about our individual happiness. And I think we do need to have a new conversation about what marriage is and what marriage means and what commitment means and what happiness means. You know, because happiness is not just a fleeting feeling that we have of this, you know, romantic feeling. And that's sort of what we've reduced it to now. If we're not feeling good in the moment, then it's not a good thing and we need to get out of it. And that's basically been a big driver behind divorce, where we forget all of those other things that are involved. We forget about forgiveness. We forget about what commitment means. We forget what it means to stick it out with someone who's going through a very, very difficult time, whether we feel in love at the moment or not. So I do think we need to have those conversations, whether we need to put some kind of a clamp for people getting married. I mean, I think we'd have a big problem in the courts today, given the other discussions that we're having about marriage and the right to have access to marriage, if we put too many roadblocks in the way. But I think those ideas are certainly important, and I think we need to be even having them instead of just sex education in the high schools. I think we need to be talking about relationships.
Let me just pick up on, but you're putting roadblocks at the end of the marriage. You don't want them at the beginning, but it's okay at the end. I don't quite understand.
Well, here's the thing. You freely enter into a marriage contract. No one forces you to enter into a marriage contract. That is something that is freely entered into. Everybody goes in with their eyes hopefully wide open. There's no government, nobody's forcing you to marry someone. And when people do marry, they do realize that they're making some kind of a deeper commitment. They're making a deeper commitment to each other, and this thing that we call marriage rises to a greater level than boyfriends and girlfriends and cohabitation relationships. And people know that when they're going into it. And with that comes certain responsibilities, certain duties and responsibilities, and certainly when you bring other individuals into the world. I mean, that is what the law is about. The law is, you know, as Margaret described it, this wouldn't be popular with people. People don't want it. The law doesn't seek, of course the law has to keep up with what is happening in our society, but the law has to be blind. The law has to do justice. The law has to serve to balance the interest of various people in the relationship that they have created and the people that they have brought into the world. And therefore, you need some kind of checks and balances in order to make that system fair and just for everyone.
Well, let me
have different parameters.
Okay, let me just pick up on something you said, and I'm trying to go back and forth here, and I do want to get to some callers as well. But Margaret, you've talked about what Beverly is talking about as a kind of paternalistic system, which is that the state gets to decide or set the rules for people wanting to get divorced, and you see that as paternalistic.
I do see that as paternalistic. I think the state's role should be to create the economic safety net that we now have. I mean, the modern divorce laws are about economics. They are not about the relationship. They're about if people are getting divorced, what is the fair way, given what they've acquired during their marriage, to divide that up and to divide potentially an income stream in the form of alimony? What's the way to put people on the best approximation of parity that you can coming out of the divorce? So there's a recognition of marriage as an economic partnership, and if people can't agree how to dissolve that partnership, there are laws that help you either negotiate or ultimately, if the court has to decide, they guide the court. And I think that's a really appropriate role for marriage. Marriage laws are incredibly protective of the economically dependent spouse and of children. I mean, now they're really separated when people have children because they don't have to be married for children to get child support.
Right.
But if the children are living in a household with a parent who is divorced, that household is likely to be way better off financially than prior to the sort of modern divorce code. And so I think that is absolutely an appropriate function of the state. I think the state telling you when a relationship should be over, or when you should enter into one, for that matter, is just way beyond what most people want. And I don't know why it would be a good thing if people don't want it.
Let me get Ryan from North Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. My question was just, you know, after listening to their conversation, was about what you talked about if you're going to mandate people to stay in the relationship at the end during the divorce to work things out, why on the front end are you not making people, say, come and apply for a marriage license and say, okay, now you'll probably have to wait 6 months before we'll actually give it to you and you both sign off on it?
That's back in your court, Beverly Willett.
I'm not sure I'm understanding. Well, I mean, I don't know what else I can say. I just explained it, you know. If people are entering into a marriage, that's different because there are certain responsibilities that go along with that and certain expectations.
Right. But the question, I mean, I put this, and I think Ryan's picking up on it as well, which is what you and your organization want to do is to have, and I'm looking at some of the Parental Divorce Reduction Act, which is to have face-to-face classes for parents that are thinking about divorce, the idea of an additional 8 months before they can file for divorce. And that's essentially the state coming in and telling people how to end their marriage. The question is, if the state can do that, why can't the state do it at the front end and tell people how they can get married or whether they can get married?
Well, as I said, you know, I think that you get into a larger issue here about the access, whatever the state is doing, are they creating impediment? Are they creating an unreasonable situation to prevent people to have access to marriage? So, I mean, I think that probably the state can do certain things, but then you have to think about what the constitutional ramifications are.
Margaret, do you
think... That's not the case, Nessus. That's not the case after people have already made a contract. This is a contract that's been made, and basically it's a contract that can be broken at will and is often broken by the party who is the wrongdoer, and the result is predetermined.
You agree with that, Margaret?
No. I mean, I think that's the basis of the contract is that if it has to be mutual, and that if one person wants to get out of the contract, as Beverly is saying, then if they can't agree between themselves about how the economics of that are going to work, there are laws that determine that. I just want to go back, though, and say something that is the state is, of course, already determining access to marriage. I mean, in this state, same-sex couples are not allowed to get married, and that's a whole huge group of people who are being denied a very basic right. And also, then there are laws about, you know, who can get married in terms of age and degrees of relationship and so forth. So it is an area that the state is regulating now, but there are just no waiting periods.
And that's Margaret Clough. She's a founding partner, Berner Clough and Watson. That's an all-women law firm in Philadelphia. On the telephone, Beverly Willett, co-chair of the Coalition for Divorce Reform. We'll get back to our callers after this very short break. And again, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Widener University. Widener offers over 60 graduate degree programs, including physical therapy, which combines classwork with hands-on learning in one of the nation's first student-led pro bono physical therapy clinics. Widener University invites you to experience its campus firsthand and to learn more about all the graduate programs designed to help elevate your professional career to the next level. Details online at widener.edu today. That's widener.edu.
Can Ukraine go it alone against its own citizens who believe they have mighty Russia behind them? Ukraine was once part of the Soviet Empire, is the black hole of history pulling them back. Putin, NATO, and the fragile Kiev government's options for suppressing the rebellion in eastern Ukraine. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Abington Health supports WHYY. Few weapons are as powerful in the fight against colorectal cancer as early diagnosis. Colorectal cancer usually has no symptoms. To aid in the goal of early detection, colonoscopy screenings are recommended starting at age 50, or sooner if there is a strong family history. If you are diagnosed with cancer, Abington Health has many treatment options. Scheduling information is available by calling 215-481-MEDI.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're exploring both sides of a question. Is it time to reform divorce laws and make it difficult to end a marriage? And again, our guests are Margaret Claw. She's a family law attorney with Berner Claw and Watson here in Philadelphia, and Beverly Willett, co-chair of the Coalition for Divorce Reform. Let me get, looks like Jerry from King of Prussia to join us on Radio Times. Jerry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I just had three quick observations here, one leading to another. If someone is saying that divorce is easy, apparently they've never been through one. And as a survivor of a divorce, I can tell you two things. One, that there are marriages that need to end. I delayed filing for about 3 years, and those 3 years turned out to be really devastating for my children. Secondly, when I finally did file, it wound up taking 7 years to conclude the divorce. And we went through the counseling stuff and all that. The counseling was just a waste of time. And the one thing that I want to mention here, and I'm turning to Beverly on this, I hope that she's reporting accurately when she says that there's a different attitude in the legal community now toward handling divorce. Because when I went through the divorce, what made it more of an adversarial process were the attorneys, one in particular. We probably could have concluded that divorce in a very short period of time, amicably. But once the lawyers got into it, it became a more contentious, a more adversarial, a more conflicting situation.
Well,
Jerry, so I just turn that to Beverly. Thank you.
No, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, Jerry. And I should say, I'm assuming that was in Pennsylvania. Beverly, let me give you a chance to respond, and Margaret as well. Go ahead, Beverly.
Yes, Jerry, I agree with you wholeheartedly that one of the big problems with divorce today is the attorneys and is our family court system, which is just basically grown into a monolith. And that's one of the reasons why divorce reform is necessary, and one of the things that the Parental Divorce Reduction Act, which has been picked up by various states and modified to fit their circumstances, is to basically try and keep the lawyers out of this. Because we believe that marriages can be saved, and then once they get to the courthouse door, the chances of those marriages being saved and those children being protected, the rates diminish greatly. The second thing I would say is that when you say if anyone believes that divorce is easy, they've never gone through one, well, it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's much too easy, and I have been through one myself. So I don't think that's necessarily one follows. The other thing is that I just want to point out that two-thirds of all divorces involve low-conflict marriages, and there's plenty of research to indicate that those marriages, many of those marriages, can be saved.
Where's that research from? I'm just curious.
I'm happy to send you links. I mean, I can't pull out the link right now, but I'm happy to send you that link. That is well documented. And there's a lot of links to a lot of this research in a big piece that I did for the New York Times a year ago, if you go on Room for Debate, and you can find the link there. And the final thing is I just wanted to mention Jerry's question about, or his comment about counseling. And that's very apropos, too, because if you also look at the research, and again, you can find the links in my New York Times piece, traditional counseling does not save marriages. Most marriage counselors are not trained in relationship counseling, and so forth. That's very, very true, and that is a very big problem. And one thing that really needs to be addressed is the way that marriage counselors are trained and how they handle couples coming to them wanting to save their marriage, because that is not the traditional role of marriage counseling, to save the marriage.
Okay, fair enough. Hold on. Yeah, just hold on 1 second, because I want to give Margaret a chance to weigh in as well.
Well, I would just say that Jerry's experience, you know, that it was not easy and that it took a long time and that he waited a long time before filing is really typical of a lot of the people that I represent. And I'm always very disturbed when I hear about someone who feels that their divorce was made worse by the lawyers involved. And there certainly are some lawyers out there who churn litigation and don't listen to their clients and really try to represent their clients the way the person wants to be represented. I mean, I don't have people coming into my office saying, I want to spend as much money as possible and I want to go to court over every issue. Everyone says the opposite. And so I feel that my job is to try to get it done for them in the way they want to get divorced, unless there is, you know, a reason when everything falls apart and that is the last resort. But I would just say to anyone listening out there, if you have an experience like that, fire the lawyer. The lawyer works for you. You're paying that person a lot of money. And if you're not happy with the way that they are working with you, get rid of them and get a lawyer that is more in tune with the way you want to handle your divorce, because it's your divorce.
And we're talking about 7 years, as Jerry
yeah.
described it. Let me get Betsy from Norristown to join our conversation. Hi, Betsy. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to say the entire concept of the government intruding further into our families terrifies me. You know, at this point, I'm sick to my stomach when I'm forced to send dental records into school. I keep thinking, why do you care about my kids' teeth? And now, you know, this Beverly is saying she knows what's better for my children than I do. That's just wrong. I mean, it's just so wrong for, you know, anybody to allow the government to say, no, you know, it's better for your kids if you stay married. You don't know anyone's situation. You don't know anyone's story. So to make these blanket proclamations is just, it's appalling to me.
Well, Betsy, let me give Beverly Willett a chance to respond to your comments. Thanks for the call. And Beverly, what do you say?
Well, Betsy, you know, divorce reform is not about stopping divorce, and I think that's definitely a misperception and a misleading thing that's been put out there. And it's not about stopping divorce. Obviously, some marriages do need to end, and there are some high conflict marriages that do need to end. Even when we had a fault-based divorce system, we recognized that there are certain situations where marriages do need to end. So this is not about keeping all marriages together and recognizing that no marriages need to end. That's just not the case at all. As far as government intruding in the bedroom, I mean, that's just ridiculous. Government intrudes in the bedroom no more than in the areas of marriage and divorce. If you just look at the $112 billion in federal benefits that get distributed every year for family fragmentation. If we cut down even a small percentage of the divorce rate and help the low conflict marriages stay together that can, we'd have a lot of money to put towards many of our economic problems that we're facing in our country today.
And you said 2/3 of divorces are low conflict marriages. Are you saying that those marriages could be saved?
Yes, and there's research to demonstrate it, as I mentioned with Bill Doherty, with research out of the University of Chicago. Absolutely. And we know, too, because of many of the people that are coming through the system, the reasons that they're giving for divorce. Mm. You know, they're not happy. They're angry. They've got financial problems. There's infidelity. There's, you know, they just can't get along. We know because of the reasons that they're giving that these things are solvable and have been solved.
Is that what you find in your office, that people come in because they're not happy, Margaret?
Well, I'd say it usually goes way beyond that. I mean, usually by the time somebody comes into my office, again, with the exception of the person who has been, like, left and had no clue, which is, in my practice anyway, it's a very small number of cases, but there are those cases. And those are, I think, the most devastated people. But most people come in and say, you know, the marriage has been over for a long time. We've tried this. We've tried that. You know, and there are, I don't find that most people that I represent have not tried to live with the and work with the problems that there are, you know, a problem of addiction, a problem of domestic violence, a problem of, you know, financial, you know, serious financial problems. Like you have somebody that's just racking up debt and the other person has no control over that. And there, but I don't even feel like it's not my role to even get into why they're getting married, why they're getting divorced. I just feel strongly about that. I really agree with Beverly. I think that people's relationships are their relationships and they should be able to make a decision. And they're the ones who know best, not an institution, not the courts, not the state.
Do you find from your practice that it's more likely that a woman or a man initiates a divorce? Have you thought of it that way?
I have read some statistics recently about women are more likely to initiate a divorce. We don't keep those statistics in my office. But the other thing is, initiating a divorce is a misleading. It's hard to know what that means because oftentimes the person who actually decides to take the initiative and file for divorce may not have been the person that initially said this relationship is over. So it's hard to know.
Let me get Richard from Paoli to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Richard. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Yes, I wanted to ask Margaret and Beverly if they've heard the way Scandinavian countries handle divorce, which is an assumption of equality in terms of parenting time and division of assets. And if there's no difference there, then there's not even any support. Both husband and wife do the best they can for their kids
and
based
everything,
on their
and
own assets.
And things get what, split down the middle, Richard?
Yeah, everything's split down the middle. It's like a prenup done by the state. Case nobody's done it, they're free to do it otherwise, but that's the way they handle it there, and it eliminates the need for fighting.
What do you think about that, Beverly?
Well, I don't really usually get into this part of divorce reform, but I think that, you know, I think that you do have to look sometimes at individual cases. You can't necessarily say one rule is going to be better for kids in a certain family, in a certain situation. You don't know what the economics are in a certain situation and some of the factors that might, weigh toward one party receiving more than another, or what happens with the kids? I mean, is it convenient for the kids to spend 50% of the time? Where do these parents live? How far is it from their school? Is this going to mean that the kids, for example, have to travel further to their school because they've got to accommodate a parent who decides to move an hour and a half away with a girlfriend? You have all of these kinds of things that I think you need to look at. So I don't think you can make a black and white rule that this has got to be the rule in all situations.
Well, let me give you a chance, Margaret, to weigh in on the child factor and helping children deal with divorce.
Well, this is one area where I completely agree with everything Beverly just said. I don't think you can have a cookie-cutter approach because people aren't similarly situated. Dividing everything, I mean, under our laws, for instance, in this state, if they make the same amount of money, they have the same amount of sort of needs and so forth, it is going to be just a 50-50 split, and there is not going to be any alimony paid. And if the children are equally living with both parents, there will be no child support paid. I mean, that is a common model, but it doesn't reflect the reality of a lot of people's lives. If you have a stay-at-home mom for 20 years and a breadwinner husband, that would not be a fair result to just split everything down the middle and not give any support to the, to recognize the contributions of the homemaker. So I agree with what Beverly's saying. And in terms of the children, there are some states that have enacted laws where there's a presumption in favor of joint custody. We don't have that here, and I think it's probably a good thing because even if you make a presumption, it just makes it really easy for courts to just say, okay, well, you're going to do that. And it's not the best thing in every case. And you do have to look at the individual situations about work schedules and geography and school districts and all of that.
I once heard someone make the argument in a divorce case with children is that the child stays in the house and it's the parents that move in and out. The idea is bring some stability to the child. And in a sense, if you want to break up this relationship,
yep,
then you do the back and forth.
And that is, I see that happening.
Yeah, hold on, Beverly. Go ahead, Margaret.
I see that happening, and we call it bird nesting. And,
oh, bird nesting.
Yep, and a lot of, I wouldn't say a lot, but I've had a number of clients, a growing number of clients who do that at least for a transitional period. Well, you know, one person moves out, they're trying to figure out what's going to happen in terms of the divorce. They do not disrupt the kids. The kids stay in the house, and the parents circle back in and out of the house. And that, you know, I think it's hard as a long-term solution because people want to have their own places and new relationships that, you know, people want to get remarried and so forth. But it's a very child-centered way to start out, and I applaud people who can do that.
Now, Beverly, go ahead.
No, I was just going to weigh in and agree on that. You know, I remember a situation just anecdotally when I was going through my own divorce and happened to be at a night at school when all of the teachers were basically telling us what the curriculum was and stuff. And some parent raised their hand and they said, "What are we going to do? We have a split household, and the child, you know, has to carry the book back and forth between homes. We need to get two books." Well, this is a place where, you know, it was a good thing the kids had books to begin with. And the parent is asking, "We need to get two books." And the teacher very basic, you know, turned to the parents and said, "You guys got to work this out. This is not the school's problem, and this is not your child's problem." And I think that was very wise. They went out of there in sort of a huff, shaking their head, and I thought that was a very wise thing. I think parents are the ones that need to realize that the burden is being placed on the children for too many things.
We have an email from Doug, and he says, "Sometimes marriage is just two good people's honest mistakes. To make it hard to end that mistake is wrong," and this is from his own personal experience. And I think we can all agree that ending a marriage, a relationship, is a very painful and difficult thing. And I appreciate the fact that both of you joined us on Radio Times. Beverly Willett, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And she's co-chair of the Coalition for Divorce Reform. Margaret Clough, thank you very much as well.
Thanks so much. My pleasure.
And our pleasure as well. A founding partner of Berner, Clough & Watson, and again, an all-women law firm located here in Philadelphia, last year wrote a book about some of the cases that she's had to deal with called Keeping It Civil. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about this program, including Twitter, Facebook, podcasts, email, satellite radio, and archives. A lot there for you to check out. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for those phone calls as well. We do.